There's a very vivid line in the Talmud which says that as much as the calf wants to suckle, so much more does the cow want to give suckle. And the context of this observation is in that of the vocation of teaching. As much as a student may want to learn, for the teacher, the offering of whatever the teacher has to offer is a vocation, is a commitment, is an impulsion, a compulsion. And I thought that I would use this moment, even though there's a certain degree of ceremony to the completion of a school year, to teach. That's my natural vocation. And I thought I would try and teach this morning in a relatively old-fashioned kind of way. You know, our ancestors who were teachers knew nothing about the 50-minute lecture hour, or about audio-visual aids, or about laboratory experiments, or about overhead projectors, or about all the other paraphernalia which modern education seems to require. They had the book, and teaching was a matter of what they called shaklavatarya, a matter of commentary on the book, on a text. The student would stumble through it, the teacher would correct the reading, the student would comment on the reading, the teacher would try to open up as many different levels of meaning in a given text as the teacher was capable of doing and the student was capable of absorbing. And of course, the basis of this educational program lay in the assumption, an assumption we would no longer agree with, that all learning was to be found in a particular literature, which our ancestors called Torah, and that the mastery of Torah was therefore the key to the mastery of wisdom, insight, and understanding. So much was this a matter of convention, that learning lay in books, in a particular library of books, that when printing made books available to ordinary people, almost by instinct, Jewish printers quite early began to print the frontispiece of a book, the title page, in such a way that you were given the title and the author and the general subject matter of the book, but all this was framed within what looks like a set of gates, or rather the pillars which hold the gates. And above these gates, you'll see very often the phrase, Zeh ha-sha'ar ladunai tzadikim yavo'u ba. This is the gate of the Lord, the righteous shall enter into it. But entering through these gates, through this title page, into the book, you enter into the world of the Lord. You enter into the temple in Jerusalem. You enter into something which is holy. You enter into wisdom. And if you want to understand why some of us have such great difficulty as we watch the end of the age of literacy and of reading, it's because we've had all these generations which have conditioned us to the importance and the value of books and to what is contained in them. So I thought today what I would do is to act like an old-fashioned teacher and teach you some text, and teach it to you from the most studied text of all by our ancestors. And I wonder if you can guess what text that would be. Some of you are saying the Bible. Well, the Bible was read ceremonially and was translated into the vernacular as part of services. But if you looked at the classroom, you looked at what we would call today adult education, you'd find that adult education concentrated on other themes. The Bible was studied through the prism of later literature, the commentaries, the Talmud, and the like. And if you think that the most commonly studied literature of our ancestors was the Talmud, this Talmud certainly provided the framework of discipline and instruction for our people. But only advanced students studied the Talmud. Talmud is difficult, it's vast, It's written in a kind of shorthand which you have to learn to unravel. And only the graduate students really went into Talmud. And if you say to me, well, the most important book probably was the prayer book. It's the book that most Jews study today. It's the Jewish book we handle most often. My answer to you would be that when our ancestors came to the synagogue, there was no friendly group of ushers to hand them a prayer book until mass printing came in the late 15th, early 16th century. There were only manuscripts. Manuscripts were not standardized. There had been no way of saying, we will now turn to page 16. Every manuscript had its own identity. And more than that, though there were manuals of what should be said when, essentially our ancestors brought their prayer book with them to the synagogue. It was up here. They knew the service by heart. They'd been reciting it since childhood, and what was peculiar and very special to a day, one of the more learned members of the community would add to that service. Now, the most frequently studied text of all by our ancestors was a short, five-chapter-long set of aphorisms, of succinct, pithy statements, which are called today the Pirkei Avot, which is often translated the chapters of the fathers or the sentences of the fathers. It was probably best translated as the founding statements of the founders, the essential platform of the founders. This volume could be written out in two sheets of a codex front and back. It could easily be copied. And we do know that at least from the 3rd or 4th century, it was the frequent, constant subject of study by Jews. How do we know this? We know this because we know from the Talmud and elsewhere that when the great yeshivot in Babylon would convene, in addition to the regular sessions for graduate students, they had two sessions, which were not unlike what we have today when we have alumni colleges. When during the summer, a college convenes whatever alumni want to come back, and the better known professors at the college teach a subject for a week or two, which was of interest to them and of general interest to the community. In the yeshivot in Babylon, these sessions were called kalot, which means simply assemblies. They occurred twice a year. And we know that a frequent subject of study in these kalot were this little text, which we call Pirkei Avot, the sayings of the founders, and that this was done so frequently that those who came to this alumni college got in the habit of going back to their synagogue and saying, oughtn't we to do that back here? There's nothing so recondite, so difficult that we can't possibly manage it. And they began the practice of reading the sayings of the fathers every Sabbath in the synagogue. And that later was reduced because of, it was a burden, took a bit of time. And because when you read the whole thing, you really don't savor any one's idea or another within it. Slowly the custom developed, probably by the 8th or 9th century in the Sephardic world, of reading the Pirkei Avot week by week, chapter by chapter, on the Sabbaths between the Passover and Shavuot, between Pesach and what we call Shavuot confirmation. And since there are six Sabbaths in that particular calendar, a sixth chapter was added to the sayings of fathers, and that's the way it appears today. Now, these five or six chapters seem to have developed into the form in which we have them by the end of the 3rd or the early 4th century. Quite early, the custom developed to publish them in manuscripts, write them in manuscripts of the Mishnah, even though they are quite unlike anything else that is in the 64 other sections of the Mishnah. The Mishnah is law. The sayings of the fathers are didactic statements about education, about ethics, about philosophy. The Mishnah rarely makes a statement in the name of one or another particular rabbinic authority. The sayings of the fathers cite everything in the name of a particular authority. But in any case, it comes from the period in which the Mishnah evolved into its present form, about the end of the second, early third century. And the men who are quoted in here, and only our men are obviously quoted, only the rabbis and Tanaim of the time, are all those who helped to fashion the Mishnaic tradition, the rabbinic tradition. Now, if you open to page 16, one of the things a good teacher does is to make sure the text is available. And the text, at least part of it, is available. You'll see, beginning on page 16 of this Gates of Prayer, what's called Fallen Chapters of the Fathers, for reasons which I'll try to explain and which I do not necessarily agree with. Those who put together this new prayer book decided to edit and select portions of the things of the Fathers rather than printing the whole thing. The smaller Union prayer book, which we normally use, has in fact the entire sayings of the Fathers. And you'll see that what it consists of is a series of aphorisms, each one in the name of a particular scholar. The scholars are listed, at least in the first two chapters, in chronological order. Each one comes from a successive generation. And that most of the ideas seem to be appropriate or apposite to our day, as obviously as well to theirs. Now, I'm always intrigued when something is missing. When you have a text and you find that the text has been changed, the question is why. And if we had the old Union prayer book with us this morning, or we had any traditional text of the sayings of the Fathers, you would find that what's marked here 1-2 would be preceded by 1-1, obviously, and 1-1 would read as follows. Moses received the Torah on Mount Sinai, and he gave it to Joshua, and Joshua gave it to the elders, and the elders gave it to the prophets, and the prophets gave it to the men of the great assembly, Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, and these used to say, be deliberate in judgment, raise up many disciples, and create a fence around the Torah. And this particular opening sentence is critical in terms of the acceptance and the importance ascribed to the sayings of the Fathers by those who call themselves traditional Jews, rabbinic Jews, the Pharisees, the Tanaim, who created the Judaism, which is considered to be orthodox today. Whenever you find somebody insisting on a chain of tradition, you can be sure of one thing, and that is that somebody questioned the authority in which they were teaching a particular tradition. There's no reason to assert tradition unless it's being challenged. What was being challenged? What was being challenged was a new concept which was being bruited about and insisted upon by the men who were quoted here, which was that at Mount Sinai, not only had Moses received the commandments, that is, the commandments which now appear in the written text, but he had received an oral tradition, an oral teaching, other laws and other teachings, and that these teachings had been passed on in a continuous, unbroken, and unchanged way, from Moses to Joshua, from Joshua to the elders, from the elders to the prophets, down to their day. And it was this tradition which the rabbis who created rabbinic Judaism turn to for authority to create the reforms of their day. Reform, as we now know it, is a reform of a reform. Rabbinic Judaism is not the extended shadow of Biblical Judaism. Biblical Judaism is centered on a shrine, the temple in Jerusalem. Rabbinic Judaism was centered on the synagogue. Biblical Judaism emphasized a dynastic priesthood. Rabbinic Judaism said authority rests with the learned scholar, the scholar who has studied the Torah. The Torah was never read in the temple in Jerusalem. The Torah is a central act and symbol of Judaism, and it studied the central virtue of Rabbinic Judaism. Rabbinic Judaism elaborated most of the laws of traditional Biblical Judaism, the Sabbath, the laws of purity, the laws of diet. All these are elaborated by the rabbis in a way that is not indicated in the Biblical tradition. And so you have a new departure, a new development. And that development based its authority on long-lived traditions. It did not simply innovate. and that claimed these traditions went back and participated in the revelation at Sinai. Now, why did the editors of this new blue Gates of Prayer prayer book of ours eliminate this first chapter? I didn't sit in on that committee meeting, but I would suggest that the answer is a relatively interesting and simple one. And that is that just as Orthodox Judaism draws to itself the authority of being traditional, of depending upon the Word of God as given at Sinai and therefore cannot be challenged, so Reform Judaism, as we know it, depends upon the authority of tradition. But that tradition for us can no longer be Sinai in the sense of a particular extended set of instructions which have been unchanged from that day to this. It has to be something more dynamic, a tradition which has certain basic themes, but these are elaborated in different ways over time. And so they took out that text which insists that the oral law and as well as the written law had been given and was the same in their day, 1,400 years later, as it had been on day one of Judaism. And they printed these texts in a way which suggests, one, that the ideas in them are still of value to us. As you read down along, the ideas leap out at you, and some of them seem relevant to our lives. Many of them do. And they printed them in a way that each one is provided with its Hebrew original. And even when we cannot read Hebrew, we see the Hebrew and associate time, history, the past, the Bible with it. And here is another kind of definition of tradition, one which emphasizes the general, the universal in ideas, the unchanging human nature, and the insights which traditional Jewish attitudes have towards it, and reemphasizes that through the symbol of language itself. Having said all that, I still wish they printed the whole text. It's impossible as a good teacher to teach a text without the whole thing in front of you. And in point of fact, when you begin to play around with an old text, you often destroy something within it which would be of interest and of value. If you look at page 17, look at the text which is labeled number 110. Shammai said, love work, hate tyranny. Both ideas that none of us could find much to complain about. Judaism has never downgraded the workaholic. Those who work are those who produce, and those who produce are those who are involved with God as co-workers in creation. Any people that begins with the Exodus and enslavement of Egypt and celebrates the Passover must hate tyranny of all forms. But as a matter of fact, Shammai said three things, not two. He said, love work, hate tyranny, va'al hikvada rashut. And do not get too close to governing authority, to those in ultimate power. And I was amused by the fact that here we have a statement that young Jews should really get involved in government. And the closer they get to the presidency and to the sources of power, the more useful it might be to us. This is that whole new power drive in the American Jewish community. And I happened to have read this and thought about this sermon as we were going through these unfortunate days before Bitburg. And I thought of that poor man, a Jew, an Orthodox Jew, who was the advisor of Jewish affairs to President Reagan and what he's been through these last several weeks. And I wondered if he wouldn't have been better off if we hadn't cut off the Altit Vadala Rashut and don't get too close to governing authority. Because when you do, you end up caught in a terrible dilemma. You're close to those who have power, and therefore, presumably, you can influence their power, but they have the power. And ultimately, they can say, unless you do what we want you to do, out the door, we'll get somebody else. So that it's a very, very difficult place. Now, putting as it does this text in a way that takes away from it its historic frame and makes it seem as though these ideas are universal, leads us, I think, to read the text in a way which sometimes blocks from us ideas which are implicit in the text in their original and may have, in fact, some insight to shed on us for today. If you take the very first of these statements, Simon the Just, a man named Shimon HaTzadik, used to say, "The world is sustained by three things, by Torah, by worship, and by loving deeds." Shimon HaTzadik was a priest, a scholar who lived in the very early part of the second century before the Common Era. And if we read this sentence quickly, what we see is rather a pious little statement which says something about the importance of Torah, the importance of worship, and that's not specified what worship we talked about, and of good deeds. But if you look at the Hebrew original, what it says, in fact, is that the cosmos, the world stands, the world depends, the world is sustained by three elements. Torah is a very specific Jewish element. It is the instructions about what we must do, which are those associated with our tradition. The word avodah is not the word worship with a small w. It is the word Jewish worship. It is the worship of the synagogue. And gemilut chasadim is not simply the good deed in the vague universal sense, but it is also and the acting in such a way that one fulfills the terms of the covenant. Chesed is that virtue which has to do with covenant loyalty. Now, each of these words, then, are both universal as they are translated here, with the exception of Torah, and they are specific. They are focused directly on the content of the Jewish tradition. Shimon HaTzadik lived at a time when Judaism was a missionary religion. It's estimated that some 10% of the population of the Eastern Roman Empire, which was just beginning to spread its authority in that part of the world, were Jews. And Judaism was, the Jews were going out and they were eager to spread the word. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. They were eager to make the world understand the value and the virtue of their teachings, that they believed to be superior to and more appropriate than those of idolatry, than those of the mystery cults, than those of the dualistic philosophies of Zoroaster and of Persia. And there was a sense that these ideas would ultimately become the ideas which all mankind would share. Now, one of the things which is strikingly paradoxical about our time and our place is that I think at no time in the last 1,800 years, certainly, at no time have there been more people who are converting to Judaism, who are joining the Jewish community. But there's no sense within the Jewish community of reaching out, in a sense of wanting to take our ideas about family, our ideas about human relationships, our ideas about the oneness of God, our ideas about righteousness and the religious, the balance with the religious life, and spreading them as broadly as we can out there in the larger world. The conversions that are taking place have largely to do with the openness of the American society. They have largely to do with love and with marriage and with on some the part of some of an individual search which brings them unbidden to my door and to the door of other rabbis. But the idea that Judaism has within it a virtue, a philosophy which might be of benefit to the world and should be shared with the world, that we are to witness to the world God's truth, that idea is one which is not broadly shared in our Jewish community. That is an idea which most Jews really don't think at all about. It seems strange to them. And yet, what Shimon HaTzadik is really saying here is not simply that it's nice to come to the church or mosque or synagogue, or that it's nice to be a person who does good deeds. He's saying essentially that the world will fall unless this particular Judaic outlook of his becomes the dominant outlook and the practice of the world at large. Now, we can accept that theme or reject that theme, but clearly let us understand when we look at the text that that is the theme of this statement, and not simply the nice
sworn statement that almost everybody can agree with, that Holy Scripture, generalized worship, and loving deeds sustain the world. They're important. But the other is equally so. Now, when we look at these statements, we find many ideas which are valued, some which we don't quite understand, some which seem contradictory one to the other. But there are two, I think, which are worth reminding ourselves of as we close the school year and as we close the worship year for Sunday. One is this, Al tifrosh min hatzibur. Do not separate yourself from the community. In an age of rampant individualism, as we go out into the world to find our way, the temptation is to set the I completely apart from we, to leave without thought of return, to focus on a future which satisfies us rather than one individually, rather than one which is, will be of concern to the well-being of so many others. I'm struck by those, as I talk to them, by those of the college graduating and generation, the young people of that age, how many of them are thinking only in terms of career. A career is important. But they're not binding into their thought of career thoughts of family. They're not binding into career thoughts of civic responsibility. They're not binding into career thoughts of what will satisfy other spiritual, emotional, aesthetic elements in their lives. Everything is focused on success, focused on promotion, focused on opportunity, the narrowest sense of the word. And this reminder of our tradition, that we ought always to see ourselves in this much more complex context, not as a single integer, John Donne's, you know, no man is an island, but as part and parcel of society, and that we must work out our destiny within a whole variety of worlds and universes. This is one which this generation might well consider. And finally, a phrase which appears also here, "Makom she'ein ish yishtadel liyot ish," in the place where people, the rabbi said, where there are no men striving to be a man, we might say today, this place where people are not acting as if they are human beings, be human. Be human. And in a world where technology and the masses are increasingly depersonalizing life, this emphasis on being human is a critical one. And in a world where it's hard to stand up against the conventional wisdom, against the enthusiasms of the time, it's very important to remember that someone has to, if the enthusiasms are wrong-directed or wrong-headed. In the place where there are no men, strive thou to be a man. In the place where others are not acting human, remind yourself that you must be human. And I've thought about that since a good bit these last several weeks as we've gone through the heartache of watching the president prepare for a trip to a German soldier's cemetery. We watched the German people trying to act out their own confusions and concerns, express some of the values which we thought had, we hoped at least, had been killed, destroyed by the last 40 years. Why did the Nazis succeed? Because Germans allowed them to succeed, joined with them. Because there were too few who were men at a time when there needed to be men, who stood up and said no. Who stood up, too many professors who refused to stand up in the faculty senates at Heidelberg and Jena and say, you can't force this Jew to resign, to be thrown out of the faculty. He is our greatest scholar. That's not the way we do it. There were too few of the wealthy industrialists of Germany who were willing to say, I won't use slave labor. That's not the way civilized people should live. There were too few in Germany who were ministers who were willing to say, we worship the God for whom all men are equal, who created all peoples. There are no lesser breeds without the law. There are no group who are parasites, who are racially inferior. We simply do not accept this nonsense. It's because Germany does not have in its legendary Nordic Aryan past the sayings of the fathers. To remind you, because there are no men, be thou a man, and much of this happened. But it's a constant monition. It's one that is as important for us, for all peoples, as it would have been for the Germans 50 years ago. And so, two things, and I'll close with this. Whenever I'm at a service, and I begin to think of idle thoughts, and I want to concentrate on other thoughts, and there's a period of quiet, I remind myself that the sayings of the fathers is in the prayer book. And no rabbi is ever going to object if you want to do a little browsing in the prayer book during the worship service. And the second, how important it is for us to have that sense of tradition, however we define that sense of the past speaking through us, that sense that this great religion of ours has lasted since the middle of the second millennium before the Common Era, that's being continued by fine young people like these, and that this sense of continuity, a continuity which has given grace to generation after generation of our people, is the ultimate proof of proof be needed. Value and its virtue. I don't know what establishes the truth of a particular philosophic proposition. I do know what establishes the value of a particular religious tradition. You must judge it by its deeds. We are its deeds. Our ancestors represent Judaism's accomplishments. It is by them, by us, this tradition must be judged. And I think that, with all humility, at least the generations past, we can say it passes with flying colors. Amen.
Please rise. Stronger by the vision of your kingdom, a world where poverty and war are banished, where injustice and hate are gone. Teach us more and more to share the pain of others, to heed your call for justice, to pursue the blessings of peace. Help us, O God, to gain victory over evil, to bring near the day when all the world shall be one. On that day, his old hope shall come true. On that day, O God,